Checking in with State Representative Tacky Chan once again for our first Tacky Talk of March, Tacky.
Happy March.
Yes, it came roaring in like a lion, too, earlier this week with that windstorm. My gosh.
Well, it's typical New England weather, right? You know, we had a fairly mild December, relatively speaking, and January was so-so, and February decided to torture us a little more, and then March, you know, was letting us remember that February isn't that far off. So what was the old saying as a kid, you know, March winds, April showers, brings you May flowers.
That's it. Yep. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, fortunately, it's been not too bad, but the fluctuating weather in terms of temperature and the wind does cause a degree of, I have aches and pains now as I get older too, for some reason. It's just strange. But wow. My funny story, the windstorm this week, I was sleeping and wake up, it was so windy, no matter how sealed this. This is actually a fairly sealed house, even though it's an older house. You know, it's going to be drafty no matter what, even the wind level. So I think a skunk was outside someplace. Got caught in the wind at like 3 a.m., like sniffing around. I was like, are you kidding me?
just to let you know, that's another sign of spring, I guess.
Around here it is, this part of Wallston. I mean, skunks in particular make their appearance during April and May. So raccoons are always year-round. But, unless it was a possum, which was probably possible too, but I distinctly think it's skunk.
Yes, it's hard to mistake for sure. Also in March, I think March 23rd will be the 1 year anniversary of the declaration of a state of emergency. It's hard to believe it's been almost a year.
It has been. I was reminding folks that my last dine-in experience was on March 14th. And my last haircut was March 14th until the cut in September. And this is, I've not had another haircut since September. So you can tell I've only had two haircuts in 2020. It's becoming somewhat of a conversational piece regarding my desire for a haircut. I will get a haircut. I will do it outdoors. Like I said, my haircut is an old friend, and we'll make arrangements for an outdoor haircut once we get to a bit warm weather, and I do not want to keep my hair in the wind. That is not desirable. But no, it is amazing how a year flies. And we've talked about the fact that even though, you know, everyone seems to have to learn a new routine, I'm still not used to this new routine. And it's quite troubling. I mean, you know, the commute's great, obviously, because we can do this. But, I mean, even I run out the door and forget to bring my mask. I turn around and get my mask. You know, my mother still insists on sanitizing the groceries when they come home.
Mm.
You know, sanitize your shopping cart when you get there. I mean, you sometimes have a lapse of memory.
True. Yeah. You just revert back to your, you know, what was normal ways, and you forget, oh, yeah, we're still in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, I'm going to be living like this even post-vaccine for some time. I am doubtful that we're going to stop wearing a mask, and, you know, most definitely please still hygiene whether or not we wear a mask. And I think there'll be a much higher standards on that, you know, even with vaccine coming through. Because remember in SARS in Hong Kong, one of the biggest changes in that island was the sanitation. I mean, I was there before 2003 and post-2003, and I'll fully admit the sanitation quality in Hong Kong before 2003 was not that great for a super dense city. Afterwards, they really upped the game on sanitation and health requirements, and they have been ever since. So, obviously that was a government mandate for a city that, you know, didn't pick up trash as frequent as it should, and street cleaning, you know, was different. I mean, but I remember being there, taking a walk in the morning, it smells bleach. Everywhere outside, you're bleaching streets, which environmentally is probably not good, you know, putting in the drainage system, but that's a different issue. But because it was right at the end of SARS, you know, a massive change in hygiene standards and much more stricter health codes, the kind of started coming out heavy on all businesses not meeting health codes. So, you know, I'm not expecting that our health departments really need to change anything regarding health codes. I think businesses will know they need to change for consumer safety and confidence. But, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if all boards of health start to, you know, get a little closer inspection on everyone's businesses just to make sure they're compliant with the current regulations.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably true for sure. And we'll probably always see these, you know, plexiglass partitions that have become so popular now, but those probably won't go away.
I don't think so. They made significant investments in these safety equipment, and which is kind of funny saying a plexiglass safety equipment, but that is what it is. And the given the fact that they're, I mean, I think you're right, they're going to be here to stay for a while. It doesn't really harm anybody. It does make it a little impersonal because they're used to having a little more face people.
Right.
But seriously, it's not like you're standing there for a long period of time on the other side waiting to pay. You know, I've learned how to use touchless credit card now. That's new, even though we've had that technology for a while. But, you know, providers now making the investment to convert over to touchless systems. And in the future, as we move to more wire, sort of cashless systems, where you're going to be paid by phone or whatnot, you're going to see more of that going on, using your cell phone to pay, more so than ever as we move forward. And retailers and restaurants and other businesses are going to have to adjust their businesses to accept cashless payments.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're speaking about remote working, and I read an article earlier this week that the governor is kind of quietly putting together some kind of a plan to start to get the state house populated again.
Yeah, I've been making this chant for quite some time on here with you that I think 30% of the white collar workforce will be returning to Boston in its current form. I do truly believe that there will be some kind of hybrid work, generally speaking, especially with white collar work. And the reason's because you can do it. We've proven you can do it. I mean, there's some infrastructure issues regarding internet and, you know, power supply, because you're going to use some power at home. And I do have an issue regarding businesses not compensating people for using personal equipment and personal home devices, whether it be internet or electricity, to business, because basically subsidizing your business to do that. I do have a concern with that. But yes, I mean, you know, certain things can be operating remote. It can keep us operating through weather emergencies. Unless you lose power in your home, you can still work from home. So you know, the idea of a state of emergency now changes how we operate. You know, there is a cost savings associated with it. As I said before, you're now not using the office's infrastructure, you're using your home infrastructure, which I truly believe we need to address at some level. But yeah, I think it's going to happen. The drawback of that is the biggest negative impact is going to be the MBTA. A lot of people travel to MBTA Boston. Boston swells to over 1 million people every day during the working hours, and still keeps over 1 million people at the nighttime because of entertainment venues. That's how much the city explodes. And it only explodes in a very specific geographic zone. It isn't like the whole city absorbs 1 million people. It's really the business districts and the entertainment districts absorbs the majority of those people. So, you know, there's going to be a huge negative impact on the economy in Boston from going to remote work. I think that's going to be the way of life. And it's going to change the commercial real estate prices in Boston. It's going to take a massive hit, but not just because the state's doing it, but I think a lot of businesses are going to be doing the same thing.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And some of the big businesses, like the banks, like State Street owns a brand new building, essentially, up there. So there's going to be some interesting conversations, I suspect, in the developer / commercial business properties are going to manage that. And we already know there's a flight of people with wealth leaving Boston to the suburbs. But that has been an ongoing feature throughout pandemic, not just in Boston. I mean, anywhere in the country, dense urban, where people have any kind of serious means to move, they're moving. Because, you know, density. I mean, you're living in a building and one person gets COVID, the whole building could get COVID.
Right.
So that also has a negative impact on Boston, because that money's leaving your city that could have been spent in the city. People that like to live in downtown Boston don't want to drive everywhere, but they want to use the amenities of the city, and they have the means to do so. Well, if they move to the burbs, sure, they got to buy a car and whatnot, but they have better means. But now the businesses in downtown Boston depends on the higher income folks or better means folks to pay for stuff won't be there. So Boston's going to have a huge ramification of economic impact over the next 3 years, even with vaccine coming. Again, I remind folks, you know, Boston's still 50% of the GDP that comes through Massachusetts, if not all of New England. GDP, well, before the pandemic, was about $880 million. So, you know, put that in perspective, exactly how much GDP the city of Boston generates. So about half of that is Boston.
So it's significant for sure, yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be huge ramifications in this, in our economy, huge. I know people don't like to talk about Boston as being, you know, Boston. But I mean, the reality is that is the hub of the mm-hmm. state.
So, do you think it could benefit places like Quincy, though?
It depends. I mean, I think any development, whether it be the new Hanover Mall that's currently under development, or you know, the new Quincy Center that's been ongoing for feels like a long time now. Even pandemic, it feels like a long time. You know, really has to address whether or not we shift in the commercial business space, right? I mean, what are you looking for? If white collar is looking to do more remote, you know, what is the future of retail? Mm-hmm. And housing is always going to be a problem. I mean, this is not a, it's going to continue no matter what. So we're going to build new housing anyway. Just housing prices are going to take a long time to find a new norm during the vaccine period, you know, post-vaccine period. But, you know, what does it mean for, you know, people that work in software? What does it mean to people that work in accounting and financial services, insurance services, you know, and so many others that can communicate in this format? They can share, you know, people are already using things like Google Docs and other shared platform office software that can people, multiple people editing at the same time, which is what we're doing now ourselves. I mean,
right.
You know, people know me, know like to do not do knee-jerk emails. I do not do that. Okay, if you email me, expect me to email you in 3 minutes, they ain't happy because, you know, we want to provide you intelligent responses, not an emotional sudden response. And as a result, you know, our staff is using shared Microsoft Word on Microsoft 365. And now we're learning to edit emails and documents and whatnot simultaneously. It's not just bills, but also letters to respond to people and how I'm going to respond by email, whether it be internal or external to the building. And we're learning how to do that. So it is a little slower because it's always easier to stand over someone's shoulder and just read off paper or read the screen together. But, you know, we're all adjusting. You know, I still predict 30% of the workforce is going to be migrating this direction in that sector, in the white collar sector mm-hmm. in particular. But I mean, you know, tax season's coming around. It's been pretty interesting to see how people change their approach on tax season. You know, you're going to communicate with the accountant. You know, a lot of stuff is coming to you in PDF format. You know, do you drop everything off and just run? Or do you, again, do you think something like this on telecommuting? I mean, I did this with my financial advisor early this year regarding, you know, my long-term plans of perhaps retiring someday. We did this for about an hour and we, you know, had a long talk about where things are and where things are going. I'm planning another physical with my doctor. I do have my shoulders acting up a little bit, but you know, I suspect what's going to happen with telemedicine. Yeah. We'll make an appointment for me, perhaps an extra MRI or whatever for my shoulder down the road if we need to. And then we'll have another telemedicine call after the results.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it could be just as effective. He can show you the results, you know, I'm sure, and then talk about it and even prescribe any treatment.
Yeah. I got a scale at home so I can get my weight. I haven't really got any taller. So that's pretty simple for me. You schedule a time to get a blood draw and you schedule a time for whatever else you need and you check back in later. I mean, right. You don't have to go there the same day and do everything at once. Like a lot of people do. You go to the doctor to take your blood draw and all the other tests for one time. I mean, you could try to schedule around your time of telecommuting, but you have the ability to, work around your work schedule to try to get these other things done. One of the actually interesting, I saw an economist, because I don't read, people know that, I've been watching economist YouTubes. So the economist was talking about the fact that they're trying to figure out the future of travel. And one of the things that may happen is what they call travelcations. I'm not sure what that means in a bigger economy. So you can actually do flex hours while on vacation. So your work goes with you, provided you got sufficient internet service. And then you kind of schedule your work, vacation schedule in some strange combination. I don't like this idea.
Yeah, it doesn't sound appealing to me either, no.
But this may be happening because unfortunately, some folks got trapped in vacation when things closed.
True.
So paradise is fun until it's not fun anymore.
Until you're stuck on a cruise ship with a bunch of sick people and you can't get off.
Exactly. Or you're stuck on a tropical island and you can't get off. There are active conversations in various industries about not just in the vacation industry or hospitality industry, but also in businesses about if they're going to start thinking about how they're going to change how they do business and how people take time off. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's something in the conversation and we'll see how it shakes out. Again, I mean, new economy, new way to do things, and we're still innovative people, I believe, and we're trying to find a way that makes it work for everyone.
Can we switch gears a little bit, Tech? You talk about the whole unemployment debacle and scams associated with that, too.
Yeah, I got my tech scam already. So there was a claim error on my unemployment. I'm not taking unemployment.
Right.
So you get some text messages coming in saying that you have a claim problem. We don't contact you by text message. It is by letter that you have a problem. My brother actually is now a victim of that too, an identity fraud, where someone stole his identity for the purposes of getting unemployment benefits that doesn't exist because he isn't taking unemployment.
Yep.
So, I mean, I do understand a lot of people having problems regarding getting the identification up online and secured. And again, an unemployment office is overwhelmed with a combination of fraud issues, customer service issues, and processing issues. So, as I said before, I mean, about 50 people is the average number they have employees. It'll gear up to like 100 so people, in a higher period. But they're around 988. They're just under 1,000 employees now hired, working 7 days a week. And I'm trying to manage all that, plus additional work you never had to do, such as fraud cases, restoring service identity, as well as, the PUA, which is not conventional unemployment. It's a whole different unemployment system set by the feds, has put a lot of strain on the administration. Now, this is not an excuse, by the way. I'm just laying out to people here what is going on, because normal, I can't believe I'm using the word normal, but I mean, under conventional unemployment, you only have one kind of unemployment. There's only one. I mean, you apply for unemployment and that's it.
Right.
You didn't have pandemic unemployment. We've never seen this level of fraud before regarding identity being stolen and additional security measures. We have to look at fraud. And then we actually have to chase said fraud to see if the money's recoverable with law enforcement. So there's all these new things that are happening on top of, standard unemployment. So I share one's frustration. My office has been, again, forwarding a lot of stuff to unemployment through our liaisons, trying to get answers back quickly. As possible, we are trying to get you back as quickly as possible. It's not been easy on us either. As you can imagine, 200 legislators also getting between 2 and 5 calls a day with unemployment problems every day, including, I do get stuff on weekends, everybody. So don't think like I have a 9-to-5 gig about Saturdays and Sundays.
Right.
I do check my emails and see, oh geez. And I contact my poor legislative staff and let them know, hey, another email is coming. This is what I think is going on. And I let them know, and they'll tell me if I'm right or wrong, and we'll check up the UA about how we should approach resolving this problem. So it's it's an ongoing issue. I don't see a line in sight right now. I don't see a silver lining anywhere as we continue this, because I still believe that right now is when all businesses have to make these hard decisions about where they're going to be next. And I think by end of April, early May is the final decision for many businesses about whether they're going to permanently downsize or unfortunately close forever.
Right.
The feds will have their new stimulus package ready by March 14th, it looks like. And the extra $400 of unemployment means that maybe more people on furlough will be able to last longer. So that's out there. And there's a couple of other interesting unemployment issues going on at the same time. One is the fact that unemployment tax rate is going to go up. And there is a push, including myself, to try to suspend the rate. But people don't know that the unemployment trust fund is funded by unemployment taxes, which is part of what you call the payroll tax.
Mm-hmm.
And that funds unemployment benefits. The state historically has always not increase the schedule. It's based on a schedule. And it's based on your employment size and how and what your layoff rate looks like, what your people letting go. So people who let go more people tend to get penalized harder, obviously. Because
they're using the system more.
Using the system more. Yeah. And it's cross-subsidization. So if you don't participate in unemployment trust, you mean you don't pay the unemployment tax and your payroll, you're picking up 100% of that unemployment cost.
Mm-hmm.
If DUA determines that employee gets unemployment, you're flipping the bill entirely. So the unemployment trust fund actually saves businesses money because it's a shared cost, not you picking up the whole freight yourself.
Right.
Particularly if you're a big company, this is, you know, helps out more. So, there's a move to kind of freeze the rate. Every year the rate moves up, the tax rate. And this, there's a move to freeze. It's under consideration by us now to see if we can freeze that rate. We have, one of the drawbacks of freezing the rate is that fact the unemployment trust fund is now empty. So we're already borrowed $2.2 billion from the feds to pay your unemployment benefits. And if we don't get, I think we have to like September, if we don't pay that money back by September, then we get charged interest. So we're in the no interest zone right now. And the unemployment, that money has to be paid via back via the unemployment trust fund. So the governor's proposing an idea to borrow money to the trust fund and then pay off the debt to the feds.
Yep.
And because interest rates are so low,
yep,
to have the trust fund pay back the bond to the state that way. And as the economy improves, obviously the trust fund will fill. And that way we not increase the tax rate, keep it where it is now, and get about a $1.9 billion, which is, by the way, still not enough money to pay all the unemployment. So we're still going to have to, put in $1.9 billion for the year, plus the bond monies, pay off the old debt, flow the bond, have the trust fund pay back the state. I know it sounds weird. Pay back the state via the trust fund for that bond to keep the benefits going. And then we really need to reevaluate whether or not we should be freezing the rate during good economies, because we do not want to find ourselves again in a borrowing situation. Even though it's a federal program, it is state administered. And the feds extending benefits through the new stimulus and the $400 weekly benefit to, I believe, August,
yep,
is the proposal in the Senate. You know, that should provide some more relief for people that are on furlough, to help them out a little more as well. Unfortunately, if you permanently lost your job, you know, this will help you get by a little longer as everyone trying to shake this thing out. So there's a lot of moving parts to unemployment benefits that I think people really understand out there. And are negative ramifications for freezing the rate. But if we increase the rate, there's massive ramifications right now on employers keeping their businesses, trying to keep the employees employed and running. So, I mean, this is one of those kind of like no-win situations. We can either hurt employers that, you know, will result in more job loss, or we're going to put, you know, go into negative, we are negative numbers already in the unemployment trust fund. And we need a short-term solution to try to do this. And the governor's proposal is actually very innovative in terms of a short-term solution. We don't intend to borrow money to run the trust fund indefinitely.
Right.
We just got to try to get past this hump.
Right. Yeah. That's the mayor's proposing a similar, move here in Quincy with the pension fund, as you may have read about, bonding the entire obligation and then, you know, paying it back at a fixed low rate over a set period of time.
That can work well, and that can blow up on you. Worcester did this many, many, many years ago, where they got into the bond market at the wrong time, and it actually cost them more in the pension fund. We've discussed this at our level. Our pension fund is about $80 billion, but was still far away from fully funded. We'll be fully funded under the current schedule to, I believe, 2030, somewhere around that area.
So,
if you're going to engage in bonding the pension fund, taxpayers will be put at risk on loaning money back to the fund temporarily if they can't get their math correct. And even though interest rates are extremely low, you know, it can also flip on you as well. So what you pick for bonding it out, because it's not just bonding it out, he's looking to bond out the debt. Okay, everybody has unfunded pension liability.
Right.
It's caused primarily from, it's caused by a lot of reasons, but one of the biggest reasons is because communities and states used, and the federal government did do this to Social Security, for those who remember. They used to pay their general operating budget on a loan from the pension funds to avoid raising taxes. Now, people don't understand, pension funds are paid by me. My salary pays the pension fund. And even though I am a legislator, the idea of taking my money to avoid raising taxes, to pay for government services, putting my money at risk is not very appetizing. And I pay over 10% of my gross income to the pension fund, which is, by the way, Social Security is at 6.5%, in case people are wondering. And all your other stuff is optional. So I, by law, have to pay significantly more than private employers. Mm-hmm. Pension. I don't get Social Security because we don't pay Social Security trust fund money.
Right.
So I'm trapped in the pension system in some ways. There's that kind of like interesting issue, because you're still using pensioners' money to grow it through investment, but they're looking for ways to pay off the debt, the unfunded liability, as opposed to using tax dollars straight up.
Right.
So the idea of bonding the pension fund means that you're going to borrow at a low interest rate over a long period. The taxpayers is paying that bond, but it opens up money in the operating account to pay for other things. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there is a risk here, depending on which direction interest rates go. Like I said, Worcester did not do this correctly, and taxpayers are paying more than it would have if they paid off the liability by straight up cash.
Mm, okay.
Rates are super low right now, but it's not as easy as I think people give it for. It's not like taking a mortgage at all, because it's a long-term issue. You're paying a 10-year bond, and depending on your bond rating, there's up or down shifting of bond rating, taxpayers may lose out.
Right.
So, I mean, I think the city's like a double A, or is it no? Is it double A? I can't remember, but I can't remember what the bond rating for the city is. I have to look it up. But if the bond rating is improved for the city significantly, and you borrowed a lower bond rating, then taxpayers lose out because you're fixed, just like you would in a capital project.
Right.
But capital projects are shorter. You're gonna borrow for pension liability. You're gonna have to borrow a decade plus to cover the whole liability, because you don't want to pay large increments in the current period. Unlike capital improvements, we have to keep rotating the money around fast. Mm-hmm. If the bond rating in the city improves dramatically and you're trapped at a low bond rating, then you lose. Or if interest rates spike, you win.
Right.
So it's a bond rating plus what the feds are going to do.
Yep.
There's also the market. So if the market's doing really well and the retirement boards are doing a good job on their portfolio mix, they can start to shrink some of that liability also. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's complicated.
A lot of moving parts to it, for sure. Yeah.
A lot of moving parts. The unemployment, the governor's unemployment proposal is much more narrow. One purpose, straight in, straight out, going to use the money here, and it's going to come straight out, and the bond goes away.
Okay.
Here, the good new pension liability purchasing is still a taxpayer risk. It's not the pension fund risk. Pension fund risk is always going to be investment risk. So obviously, pension funds tend to be fairly conservative and extraordinarily diversified.
Mm-hmm.
And the pension fund is actually an interesting place for new financial investors, or I'm sorry, new financial brokers to get the start in the business, because they set aside small portions for minority women and first-time small business brokers to try to get their business started. So it's actually kind of an interesting tool to help small first-time brokers to get out there and get started if they can meet the state's qualifications, which is extremely stringent because we don't like to put pension money at risk.
Sure.
But it's actually creates some interesting opportunity. We're not talking giving like $1 billion, tens of million dollars, relatively small than the size of the fund is a start point. So, that's something the state's been doing for quite some time. People haven't realized that you can use relatively small amounts of money to help some business get kick off in this financial world, mm-hmm, sector.
Yeah, that might be very crucial in the years ahead, too, for sure.
Yeah, so it's not an awful idea at all,
mm-hmm,
but it's something that has a lot of moving parts. And it really depends shifting the pension liability, how much of the pension liability costs you're trying to shrink on the taxpayer's dime to becoming a part of your debt load section of your budget.
Right, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the vaccine rollout, Jackie, and whether you think teachers should be prioritized over other quote-unquote essential workers, grocery store workers, transit workers, delivery workers, folks like that.
Well, as we've all seen, the general frustration with the governor has been the constantly moving target. So just like as we complained about business shutdowns, that the governor cannot keep a consistent message off the bat, it seems like you throw an idea out there that people lobby to change his mind. And it can happen within a week. We saw that with the whole idea of caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
Caregivers getting a vaccine when they go to give their 75-year-old person a shot. And, you know, they announced that like a week after they initially opened the 75-year-old bracket. No, nobody was ready to deal with that. They weren't ready to deal with it after they announced it.
That's right.
So same thing in phase one. I mean, trying to figure out who in healthcare fits in these phase one categories and where they all are. And now the most recent change is moving teachers up. So in phase two, you've got 75-year-old people older. Then we're down to 65 years older and or persons who have two comorbidities that is listed on the state website, which I'm not going to repeat to you, the dozen different health conditions involved. And then they have now moved to teachers, head of food service workers and others.
Right.
So obviously, everybody who have children is getting exhausted, whether it be on a hybrid system or purely online. And we all agree that children do need to be in a social setting in schools. There's an enormous benefit to that. And I think everyone now has up close and personal understanding of this.
Yes.
I'm not going to lecture you on this stuff because you all know. So it really comes down to how we manage the priority list, right? And the argument's pretty sound. I mean, kids go to school. They can bring the disease with them, despite the fact not having a lot of symptoms. And on the flip side, CDC studies show that school infection rates, when properly addressed in terms of safety, has extremely low transmission.
Right.
And a lot of the prior to the start of school year, people were going to parties, and mostly teenagers, and Milton closed their school system because of that, right? So it was not actually in the schools causing the problems. People, I don't know, misbehaving before they went to the school, right? So I think there's plenty of those news stories all over the country, right?
Oh, sure. Yep.
Along those lines. And I think the desire to open schools to satisfy both parents and teachers' safety, you know, is one of the big impetus of moving up the list. Now, To put another perspective on this matter so people can get the fuller picture here, you do have a number of folks that have been through the whole pandemic on the front line, so we're not teachers, with namely people that you see at the grocery stores especially.
Yep.
The most visible everybody here listening will know is the people getting your food delivered, but most important people at the grocery stores before they got the shields up, you know, bagging, stocking, sanitizing, and taking your purchases. We've all been in grocery stores. You know, there's every 15 to 30 minutes, someone's wiping every single surface down. You know, and it's not cheap. You know, food costs are gonna go up because they're out there doing higher degree of sanitation than ever, and they have to pay for all this new equipment, and they have to get more employees because people get sick or stressed out. And,
right.
Have to do more rotations, and they need more manpower because they're not just stocking shelves anymore. They're doing a whole lot more than stocking shelves. So the other funny thing about that demographic is that, you know, they're not young either. They're not all teenagers. Those days are long gone. They're also traveled by public transit, many of them. So your exposure risk goes up because the longer you're in public, the more, especially anywhere we have other people here. And a lot of these folks live in lower socioeconomics where there's an unusually high number of COVID cases. And same thing with people in the cleaning service industry, lower socioeconomic, high COVID case communities. So I get moving teachers up in the general safety sense, but also for prospective folks, so you understand, you know, the shifting priorities. You also got a whole other series of folks who have been arguing about, these are high-risk communities because high COVID cases. When you look at the demographics and where they work, they're the ones that have been out there the longest that are not healthcare workers in public safety, working for us in a public open setting, taking public transportation.
Right.
But they also have the same challenges all we all have, because since their jobs require to be physically in person, they don't have childcare services. Mm-hmm. Opening schools is also very important for them too, because they need to get, you know, rearrange how they do their lives. Because if you live, let's say, in a situation where you only have your grandparents or your parents to take care of your kids when you're working, COVID kills older people at a higher percentage. So one of the struggles we had very early on was providing child daycare services for everybody that was essentially essential worker. But because of safety standards and distance and, you know, location and everything else, it became very challenging to keep those businesses functional too. We haven't even talked about child daycare services.
It's true.
And the negative impact COVID's had on them. I mean, ginormous negative impact through the entire sector. And the new guideline safety standards make it even tougher for them to operate. Okay, it doesn't matter if you're a private for-profit or a not-for-profit subsidized service, but a government. I mean, both of them are in deep trouble. But that's a different conversation. So it is an interesting perspective, right, if I present it two ways. On one front, you know, the teachers union advocated very heavily to provide vaccinations up the list. Parents support this position. Whether you're you can work from home parent or your person has to go to leave the house to go to work parent. Flip side, you do have a certain workers that come from high risk communities mm-hmm. to work. They have to work in person because of the nature of the job, and they're most likely to be taking public transit.
Yeah. The governor said it himself. He'd like to give everybody in the state a shot right now. The biggest hurdle is the supply, it seems.
Yeah, it's really screwed up because everyone hates the Thursday lottery. It's so awful.
Right.
1 week we get 90,000 vaccine doses. Next week we get 20,000.
Right.
Who knows how many we're getting next week?
We don't know. That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is kind of the frustration I have, the governor has, you know, everybody in government has, and I think the public has as well. I don't think the public understands entirely exactly how screwed up this is, where you have like such an inconsistent dosage amount. So we got over 1 million doses, first doses into people's arms this week. But we started receiving vaccine back in January. Now it's March. But it's been such an inconsistent rollout that we can't say we can schedule 50,000 a week, every week, we'll start a queue up.
Right.
And we'll just try to get through the priority list via the queue. The governor has adopted the fact that he's going to stay to his schedule as close as possible in his rollout of the different phases, whether or not a phase is completed or not, because of factors. One is, you know, logistics of getting to everybody, and it's not realistic to make everyone else wait because they have vaccines that's going to expire, because Moderna, Pfizer has such a sensitivity in storage and shelf life. And secondly, it's not mandatory. People have to volunteer to take the vaccine, which if you don't take the vaccine, puts everyone else at risk. Yep. And the argument is, well, I don't want to put myself at risk. Well, there's a whole lot of other people taking the doses right now. So you can see how it works with everybody else, because everybody else has health issues. So if you're not comfortable today, just wait it out. I mean, right, globally, there's been very low number of negative impacts of anybody's technology of the vaccine. Doesn't matter if you're using the American-made vaccines or the European-made vaccines or the Chinese-made vaccines. There have been very low cases of negative effects. So, you know, if that's one of your concerns, I mean, you know, once again, think about other folks. And the reality is that we have the biggest clinical trial ever seen when you're trying to, you know, do hundreds of millions of people at one time with vaccine. So, you know, that's out there. But you're, you know, that's a whole different podcast we can do.
Yes. Great.
So, I mean, you got that kind of all these kind of moving targets inside of it all. And the governor is going to probably most likely still keep maintaining his schedule despite, you know, the dosage. If the dosage is extremely low, he'll push back the cycle because there's not enough to go around. So, yeah, I mean, this kind of like really lack of consistency is really troubling, because it's hard for you to plan injections if you don't know what you get. And, for example, we're getting 50,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson, which we talked about before, about how this is a game changer. But we can't put a next order in for Johnson & Johnson to March 25th.
Oh, okay.
So all the Johnson & Johnson we got is all the Johnson & Johnson we're going to have.
Yeah.
And we can't put the order in, not get, put the order in until March 25th.
Okay, so it's going to be a while. It's going to be most of this year, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I give President Biden credit here. President Biden, you know, was able to get Pfizer and Merck to work together on making more vaccine quickly, which will trim down the timeline on a vaccine that's one shot, regular refrigeration, and longer shelf life. And, you know, he did a good job. I mean, this should have been done with PPE during the Trump administration.
Yes.
Scrambling to build up. They should have done the same thing last year, the same way that President Biden had managed to work out a deal between Pfizer and Merck, two of the biggest pharmaceuticals in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the pharmaceutical industry needs specialized equipment. So you just can't pick any business and say, hey, we need to pay you, but we're going to make you do this, but we're going to pay you to do it.
Right.
You have to have the right business to do it. And the fact that the president was able to work out an agreement between two huge competing pharmaceuticals to utilize Johnson & Johnson's formula is an enormous deal because they have a similar equipment to do so. But we should have been do that last summer on PPE, all these P's, you know, protection equipment. We should have done that last year. So I mean, you know, President Biden has really, really demonstrate the ability to negotiate with private business, use the position in the office not to bully people, but to work out an arrangement that makes sense for everybody involved, including the businesses themselves, mm-hmm. you know, for the benefit and safety of all of us.
Yeah, and you know, those businesses employ people too, so it's keeping them robust and employed as well.
Yeah, and even, you know, with the Johnson & Johnson, you know, he's going to have enough vaccine every adult in America by May. You still got to get those shots in the arm.
Right.
And that's why J&J is so interesting. Johnson & Johnson's regular refrigeration, one shot, longer shelf life is such a game changer because the scheduling, people have done this listening, have already done the 3-week scheduling. You know, you're going to make time to do it. I'm not saying you can't make time to do it, but there's always that kind of like, okay, we got to coordinate with the person that the hospital or the vaccine center or whomever, coordinate to make sure that the timing is correct and everybody comes in. And then there's also that second dose issue. So even though we're getting more doses of Pfizer, Moderna, you have to make sure there's enough left over for dose two.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just consume all the Moderna vaccine that comes up because you have to be able to set aside a portion for dose two. If you don't, then you don't get dose two, then it's not as effective.
Right.
It's got to be within a specific time frame. That's why Johnson & Johnson is such an enormous game changer because of all the reasons that is different. So mm-hmm. it should help speed of vaccination. But that being said, you know, you still got to transport it. You still got to organize it. You got to get people to want to take it. And you got to get into people's arms. And, you know, even though we have 1 million first doses, I mean, there's about 4 million plus people that are over the age of 18. And it's now March, and that's only dose one. So that means 1 million plus people have to schedule for dose two, you know, of which I think about 250,000-ish. I have to look it up. The numbers keep changing because every single day they're different. But 250,000 plus, so 300,000 plus are already had dose two. We still have a lot more people left.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't joke about it, but you and I are probably looking at the summertime if realistically speaking,
if we're lucky, even to get a first dose, if it's, you know, one of the two dose shots,
realistically speaking, they got to schedule for those doses. So I mean, I'm sure we're all going to find time in our day to make this happen. I mean, it isn't like in the scheduling properly done, you know, it's going to just rotate people through, just because you have the medication available doesn't mean it's going to be magically in everybody's bodies that quickly. But again, the key is the extension of shelf life, and the storage requirements really makes a huge difference.
Sure.
On distribution.
Any talk about getting legislators back in any form at all, Tacky?
No. Okay. We're still going to operate in this format. The House still has emergency rules to July 15th.
Okay.
We are received notice from Speaker Mariano that we are getting new equipment. We are getting laptops. We are doing We also look like we're going to be heading to a hybrid model of workplace. Hopefully at some point I'll be using a different device to talk to you in this format, maybe even from the office someday.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And see if I can find proper Wi-Fi connection at the office. Watch me scramble in and out from the state house Wi-Fi system, which is trying to penetrate all that concrete and granite. But yeah, I mean, we are doing that now. One of the challenges I think everybody's faced this entire pandemic is buying electronic equipment.
Yep.
Semiconductors are in high demand. The United States is one of the biggest semiconductor manufacturers on the planet, followed by places like Taiwan, big manufacturers. And actually, there's a car shortage as a result, because there's a lot of computer chips in your car. But right now, chips have been prioritized towards electronic devices, namely phones, laptops, phones. And oddly enough, kitchen equipment.
Yes, I was reading about, refrigerators, ovens, they're all, electronic these days.
Yeah, I do not know why I need my refrigerator to tell me what's going on inside of it. However, this is the world we live in now, right? I mean,
I have to go back to the Iceman making coffee.
Absolutely. It's such a weird world we live in where I have to say things like that. Yeah, you can't get a fridge because you can't get a chip. And you're like, what?
I know.
Yeah, I've been the same mentality too. I'm with you all. So it's a supply problem. We are unable to get ourselves mobile devices for ourselves and our staffs. And it has been a priority for us for a long time. And, they are in the process of doing a migration to do that. As we said earlier, one Microsoft 365. Mm-hmm. Our public hearings are going to be on Microsoft 365. We're not going to use Zoom. The staff and I are starting to try to figure out how to do virtual hearings through this software. I'm going to do some test runs because unlike other people's meetings, when you do a public meeting, it's not like a regular meeting.
Right.
It's not like you're being put in a timer of how long you can speak. You don't have to figure out how to use the queue. You don't know how to deal with someone's being less than civil in this format. I do not have a gavel or a court officer in the room to try to gavel you down or ask a court officer to address the unruly behavior. I mean, this is completely different.
It's the wild, wild west, basically.
You guys are just going to use like normal conference meetings. No, these are not normal conference meetings. And then what do you do if you have like technical difficulties? We had to have testifiers when we were using Zoom to do hearings where people couldn't get on. They couldn't find a phone number. We were like sitting there in awkward silence. We're sitting here for 10 minutes in this like, we can't do witty banter because we're going to witty banter about in this dead space. And in a public hearing in person, if you're not available, we just move to the next person. And then just kind of reshuffle the order, or we call recess for 10 minutes and then we go to the bathroom, we'll get a cup of coffee, whatever, just recess.
Right.
You can't do that because if you recess and they come on in the middle of a recess, then nobody's there and then you have to get one back, but everyone's using your phones and it's different, okay, everyone? It's very different. So I'm working, as you can tell, I'll be thinking about how to work out the logistics in the public.
Sure. Yeah.
We're that format. Unfortunately, for better or for worse, I mean, we're kind of in this situation. And again, I remind folks that the majority of our staff is under the age of 30, 35. You're very young. And we're at the bottom of the list.
Right.
The legislators and the few staffers that are over age 65, are also struggling to get vaccinated. There is no special priorities for legislators.
Mm-hmm.
I've already heard from my colleagues over age 65, they can't get on the mass vaccination system either. So they're trying to figure out themselves, how to get themselves vaccinated.
Right.
Will legislators get advanced up the line? Probably not. I just don't see a scenario that will happen because right now we're able to operate in a remote format.
Yeah.
Imperfectly. It's imperfect, but we're somehow operating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's reality of the situation, the current situation. So we were completely dysfunctional and we need to get back in person because just essential service at this stage. Yeah, but we're not. We're able to figure out how to make this work. And it's not perfect by any stretch, but still able to make it work, but still functional.
Right, yeah. So yes, your hands are not tied at the moment. So status quo, basically.
status quo for now. So we're still adjusting, new technology, new ways of doing things, a lot of trial and error. Like I'm having my first committee meeting of the membership of my committee on Monday. I have to walk them through, you know, what's going to happen to session, what's pending on the list, how I operate, and how we're going to operate with the Senate. So the first House meeting is next week, and you know, we're going to have to do a joint committee get together to get everyone introduce themselves in the joint committee, and then I'm going to have to schedule more meetings with my co-chair, and then you know, bills will be probably available for the committees by the clerk sometime in May, I would think, the current pace. Unfortunately, we lost a member of the clerk's office, passed away in the House, which doesn't help the situation because now they're shorthanded. And we have about 4,000 plus bills that have been filed in both branches. The House generally has about 2.5 times more bills filed than the Senate. And they have to refer those bills to committee. So everyone looking online to see House docket. Well, it's a House docket to get a House bill. When it's a House bill, it gets a committee.
Right.
So it's a committee of a House bill. So I expect maybe early, mid-May at the earliest that committees will get bills. So this gives me time to set up the committee in this strange format we're living in, set up the office staff on how we're going to manage the year, because every year is different. This year has been more different than the others.
Well, that is true, yeah.
I'm working on a timeline of hearing schedules and everything else. And
yeah.
I've said this before. I found it very challenging sitting in one spot for more than 2 hours.
Yeah, I was reading about Zoom fatigue earlier today, actually, and it is a real thing for sure. And I think everybody's experienced it.
Oh yeah, I've done, you know, my old days before I got back to the state house, but when I was still working in the Senate, I mean, I've done 13-hour hearings. Mm-hmm. So in person, I know what that's like. You know, the idea of managing something like that in this format is just not palatable.
Yeah.
So you know, we are actually trying to figure out how to, even before I get the bills in committee, start figuring out how we're going to run these hearings in an orderly form to do so, and then, you know, prioritization over that. You know, today, the Speaker's office contacted me about who is my policy contact with the Speaker's office. So, you know, the Speaker's office already started restructuring their policy staff around the new committees and who's going to communicate with whom. I've got a meeting scheduled already on the phone with Denise Garlick, new chair of the House Committee on Third Readings. The previous chair, Ted Spriotis, and I had a very good relationship on how we're going to operate together between my committee and his, because I have so many local petitions that come through my committee that we had to set up a system that keeps the members from freaking out because they can't get their local petition moving fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to work out a way to make that more smooth so the members can get their bills out faster on the local petitions. The new Denise Garlick is from Needham. She's in my class. We came in the same year. So, you know, it's going to be a great conversation. Just going to have to kind of work out how we're going to work together on that stuff. And, you know, continue. I actually have to give Bill Driscoll a call from Belton. She has the COVID-19 committee.
Yep.
Yeah, because some of my consumer issues and my licensing issues and stuff rotated to that committee. Well, while I'm not on that committee, there's some cross-pollination. I need to get some feedback from Bill about what's going on. So there's going to be a lot of, you know, still ongoing conversation among the different chairs and even non-chairs about priorities and operations through this COVID situation.
Yeah. Speaking of calling, here's the point where I ask you how folks get a hold of you, Tacky.
617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. People have taken me up on the fact that just hit any staff person and go to that voicemail. That has happened. So please feel free to do so. We get your voicemail via email. So there is that time delay. But oddly enough, if you tell us on a voicemail what's going on, it's actually easier than reading your email, shockingly.
That's right, yeah.
It's very concise. I've noticed when people try to leave a message, even though it takes a little bit of practice, but people are actually very concise. Of course, you can always email tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. I do check my emails, as I said earlier, a lot more, but I also get a lot more emails at the moment, so it is piling up fast. My Facebook website, State Representative Tacky Chan, does have a lot of information. You may not need me to call us or email me. You can connect yourself to the various links, as well as tackychan.org. a lot of resources there. Again, you can bypass having to contact us, and we can find resources there to help you out. So, you know, obviously we encourage people to try to use our existing online resources to save you time. But if that's not helpful, obviously give us contact directly. If you believe you may have a fraud issue or scam issue regarding income taxes because it's tax season, you know, same thing with vaccine and healthcare or DOA, well, most definitely contact us, and we can try to help identify whether it is a scam, question one. And secondly, you know, if there has been some issues, we'll try to see if we can help with DOA and other organizations depending on circumstances.
Very good. Good to see you as always. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, no, it's good to see you. Enjoy our weekly chats. And, you know, we can, we'll see you again next week, which will be, what is today? Today is what, the 6th?
Today's the 5th.
The 5th. So in 7 days, that's the 12th. So closing on the Ides of March.
That's right. Yes. And
coming close to that day.
That'll be the weekend. We spring ahead on our clocks, actually, March 14th.
And then St. Paddy's Day is the 17th. That was the last day I was in the State House before I had to go pick up some stuff in May and my plants, and then appearing in December. So, yeah, because that was 17th, I remember, only because that was my Ways and Means meeting.
Okay.
It was canceled suddenly because of a COVID positive test case in the State House.
Yes, that's when the you-know-what was hitting the you-know-what at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, immediate evac. Once that happened, because I didn't get my meeting Ways and Means that day, obviously.
All right. Maybe you'll have a haircut by then.
Yeah, maybe by next week. If there's good weather next week, if I can make it happen, there'll be a haircut.
Yeah, it's supposed to be in the 60s later next week. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be nice to see that better weather.
Yes. All right. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you. Talk to you next week.